This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Angela Saini is an award-winning journalist and author who doesn't back away from exploring challenging topics. She's the author of four books, including Superior, The Return of Race Science, and Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong. Her latest book, The Patriarchs, The Origins of Inequality, delves into the question of how patriarchy became embedded in societies around the world. On September 19th, she'll deliver the Mercantile Library's Science and Nature lecture based on that book. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss the patriarchs and what she learned while researching the book is journalist and author Angela Saini. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. The big questions that your book and research seem to tackle for this project are, have we always had the patriarchy, and do societies kind of naturally organize around male leaders? What did you find in exploring those two questions?
It is a very big question, but I think the main takeaway from my research was that what seems inevitable, so often, you know, especially because it's so old and it feels so embedded and widespread throughout the world, that we imagine patriarchy to be inevitable and there from the beginning. And actually, the historical evidence just doesn't really support that at all. These are ideologies, ways of organizing ourselves that we've introduced only within really the last few thousand years, and they've built up over time, and they're not even universal. So there are many societies around the world that even now are not what we could call fully patriarchal, that have matrilineal family structures.
What are some of the defining characteristics of a patriarchal society?
They're all different. There are some similarities, partly because we have homogenized the way that we live around the world. You know, we have states and we have democracies, we have capitalism. These are kind of basic rules that keep most of the world's countries turning. And embedded within those are, you know, major religions that also, some of those also mandate, in some cases, this idea that there are gender roles for men and women, that there should be a hierarchy within the family, that the father is at the head of the family. And that's literally what patriarchy means. The word itself means the rule of the father. So this idea that the father is at the head of the family, and within a state or within a community, a man is also at the head of that society.
Your work, and you referenced this just a moment ago, your work explores matrilineal societies. First, can you explain the difference between matrilineal societies and a matriarchy? Is there a difference there?
There is. So if you want to imagine matriarchy as perhaps being the polar opposite of patriarchy, so you could imagine something like we've seen in the recent Barbie movie, you know, Barbie Land, in which the women are entirely in charge, that maybe is a society we could call a matriarchy, in which all the women are doing everything. In that sense, you know, matriarchies, we don't see real matriarchies like that on the planet today. Maybe they existed in the past. We don't know. We don't have evidence of that. But we do have very many matrilineal societies. So these are communities in which descent and name is passed from mother to daughter rather than from father to son. And every single one of them is different. Anthropologists have catalogued at least 160 across the Americas, across Africa, all right across Asia. And in some of them, you have goddess worship. So, you know, everything is organized around this idea that a goddess is the ultimate deity. In some, the father is quite peripheral to the family. So you have some societies, matrilineal societies, in which, for instance, everybody lives in their mother's house over generations. And this means that fathers are not necessarily raising their own children. They're raising their nieces and nephews instead. So there is a lot of difference. There's a lot of variation among these societies, but what they have in common is that very often power and authority is shared between men and women.
I would just like to say I'm so glad you were the first person to bring up the Barbie movie in this conversation because I really wanted to ask you about it. I thought, here is this accomplished, award-winning, impressive scientist, and I want to ask a question about the Barbie movie. So thank you for bringing that up first because I was thinking about that as I was, reading about you and the work that you've done. People around the world have seen this Barbie movie, which has its own kind of pink-tinged take on the patriarchy, and it shows how Kens were disadvantaged in Barbie's world, this matriarchy where women were in charge. What does your research show about, whether there can still be this inequality in matrilineal societies?
You know, there is a matrilineal society in northeastern India, the Khasi, who live in the state of Meghalaya, in which men are agitating for rights right now. So there's a men's rights movement in this community because at the moment, property and inheritance is passed to daughters rather than to sons. So the sons are asking, why can't we have a share of that inheritance? And also, children inherit their mother's names rather than their father's. So again, they're asking, why can we not pass down our names to our children? And it's actually not getting very far because if we think about one of the reasons that societies don't change or they're resistant to change is because of culture. And this is wrapped up in our faith, in tradition, in custom, all the different things that give us a sense of self and identity. And among the Khasi in northeastern India, their identity is very much wrapped up in matrilineal. You know, this their entire sense of who they are as a society is wrapped up in that. So there's actually been resistance among many of the men as well as the women to this men's rights movement there.
Tell us about the ancient society of Çatalhöyük in Turkey. What do we know about that? It seems to be a little bit murkier than just a matrilineal society or a patriarchal society.
Yeah, well, one of the first places I visited when I was researching the patriarchs, it took many years of research, was Çatalhöyük, which is this very famous ancient settlement, more than 9,000 years old, in modern-day Anatolia, southern Anatolia, which is in Turkey. And just to get your head around how old 9,000 years is, this is 5,000 years before the first pyramids went up in Egypt. It's older than Stonehenge. It's older than writing. So we don't have written evidence from this period of time. And what's remarkable about this settlement is that it is so sophisticated. Thousands of people lived here. This wasn't some kind of simple, farmers or hunter-gatherers. This was a very sophisticated settlement in which thousands of people lived over a very long period of time. Houses, homes that we can recognize the shape of, these kind of box-like houses with a hearth, very careful burial practices, beautiful murals, red murals painted on the walls. And yet every measure that we have of gender inequality using archaeological data, so we can learn a lot, for example, from human remains, the way that people are buried. There's lots of things that archaeologists can glean from a settlement like that. And what we can see is that men and women lived pretty much the same lives. They ate the same things. They did the same kind of work. They spent around the same amount of time indoors and outdoors. There is no sense at all that women were invisible because we actually have from that period of time and that entire region around the Fertile Crescent, we have more female figurines than we do male figurines. And some of them showing women in very authoritative, almost matriarchal poses, if you want to think of it that way. So what's interesting about Çatalhöyük is that it reminds us that prehistory, the Neolithic, was not necessarily gendered in the same way that societies are gendered now.
You mentioned, these men and women, the evidence that they were doing the same work. They were, there were men and women who were hunters and warriors. There are these figurines of these powerful women figures. So does that indicate to you that it was matrilineal or just that it was more equal?
It really points towards it being more equal. We don't see much evidence of a gendered hierarchy. It's very difficult to say, when you're looking at a site this old without written evidence, and even the murals on the wall don't seem particularly gendered, you can't discern whether they're males or females that are being depicted there. it's hard to know what people were thinking and what their private lives were actually like. But certainly all the evidence we have, and this is certainly what the lead archaeologist at that site, Ian Hodder, who's an archaeologist at Stanford, he said to me that this wasn't a particularly gendered society. We can't say that it was based on the evidence that we have.
I want to remind our listeners, I'm talking in this recorded interview with journalist and author Angela Saini about her most recent book, The Patriarchs, The Origins of Inequality. Angela, one of the things that you've talked about that I think is so interesting, other scientists, primarily male scientists, have looked at evidence of equal societies or matrilineal societies over many years. And I'd like for you to talk to us about how they've explained this evidence. You talk to us about the matrilineal puzzle, as some of these scientists have put it.
Well, you know, I imagine some of your listeners are wondering why we don't have entire libraries full of books on this topic, you know, the origins of patriarchy. It feels like such a big question. The last big book that was written on specifically this subject was Gerda Lerner's The Creation of Patriarchy, which is around 40 years old now. And I think part of the reason for that is just alluding to what to your question is because we don't look at the past with objective eyes. Very often scholars, particularly until recently, you know, before women entered archaeology and history and science in very big numbers, just assumed that the past was far more gender unequal than what we have now, that men were always the hunter-gatherers or the hunters and women were kind of staying at home looking after children and being mothers and nurturers, almost like the Flintstones. You know, this is what we picture in our heads, that it was kind of like this 1950s stereotype, but transposed onto the Stone Age.
Yeah, the honeymooners in animal skins, right? Yeah,
absolutely. And it really wasn't like that. All the evidence points in exactly the opposite direction. I have this anecdote in the book from when in 2018 in Peru, archaeologists discovered the remains of what was clearly a hunter. This was someone who was buried, again, 9,000 years ago. They were between 17 and 19 years old when they died, and they were buried with these stone hunting implements, you know, projectile points, knives, that kind of thing. And so it was very clear that it was a hunter. It was categorized as such until analysis showed that the hunter was female. And then other archaeologists started weighing in. There was one male archaeologist who told National Geographic magazine something like, "You can't just stop in the middle of hunting to nurse a crying baby," betraying this idea, this notion that that's all women have ever done is nurse crying babies, that we haven't even had time to do anything else, which is just bizarre because we know, obviously, from our own lived experience now that that's not true. But it's shocking how much that sexism still colors how we think about the past.
How has the patriarchy spread? When and where do you really see these more rigid gender roles being enforced?
You see them emerge with the rise of the state. So with the very big first early states in regions like ancient Mesopotamia, that's when you see the big gendered rules. But even then, there is a lot of negotiation and shifting. For example, we have Assyrian cuneiform tablets, which show men and women negotiating their rights to divorce within marriage, you know, rights, negotiating rights for themselves that women much later wouldn't have. Where we see, I think, perhaps the most rigid and misogynistic of gendered societies is in regions like ancient Greece. So in ancient Athens, you see very clearly in the literature this deep-seated, almost seething hatred of women, the suspicion of women, these rules emerging that say that at least upper-class women should stay at home and be indoors all the time, covered up and veiled, and men can have public lives. So I think that is kind of, in antiquity at least, that's the peak of what we would now call patriarchy. But even then, in the rest of the world, in other parts of the world, you see a lot more variation in how these rules and codes are exercised. The modern state, so this is just within the last few hundred years or so, was really built on patriarchal principles. So in Europe, for instance, you get very rigid ideas that treat women as property. It's only relatively recently, actually, that many of those laws have been lifted that allow women to work, to keep their own property, to keep their own wages. It wasn't that long ago that, for example, in France, in the 1970s, a man had the right to stop his wife from working because her labor was seen as his property.
The situation in ancient Greece that you talked about, this disdain for women that's so clear in the historical record, what are the roots of that? Where did that come from?
It's hard to say, but the way that classicists are now interpreting some of that evidence is to not take it at face value. When you read literature in which there is a hatred of a group of people or a marginalization of a group of people, often, you know, that isn't just because that group is naturally inferior within that society. It's because there is this desperate need to keep that group oppressed. So I think, you know, what you can read in much more modern classical academic literature is an understanding that what was happening in ancient Athens was trying to impose a gendered order on a society in the recognition that people didn't naturally fall into these roles anyway. So, you know, it's not natural. They know it's not natural, but how can we keep reinforcing this idea that women have a certain place, that they are inferior to men? And I think that's a lot of what that literature betrays.
How does this idea of gender even fit into the patriarchy? You've done some interesting research on that. I mean, even these gender constructs are not something we as humans have always had, are they?
No, and not even now. I mean, different cultures think about gender in very different ways. We, you know, depending on the society that we're raised in, we don't imagine that to be the case. We think it's just normal or natural. If you grow up in the US, it's very normal and natural to believe that, you know, humans are naturally heterosexual, that we fall into nuclear families, that, you know, there are certain gender roles for men and women, because the United States was built on that principle, this idea of the domesticated housewife and the working public man, the husband, the father. But that isn't universal, not by any means. And certainly the further back you go into history, the more variation you see in how gender is understood and exercised. Like I said, in Çatalhöyük, we don't necessarily see a very gendered society there at all.
What about the role that population plays in this need to control society and the connection between population and the state? Talk to us about that.
Well, the argument I make in The Patriarchs, and this is just based on the historical evidence that we have right now, on the archaeological and scientific data, it could be that new data comes along and changes everything, rewrites everything. But just working with what we have, we don't see signs of gender depression, for example, emerging with the rise of agriculture. We have agriculture and domestication of animals and plants for many thousands of years before you see any signs of gender depression in the historical record. It's really, as I was saying earlier, with the rise of the state. And part of the reason for that is that in those early states, the elites, those in power at the top, who in the beginning would have been women and men, what they were most concerned about was, how do we get people to stay in our state? How do we get them to not leave and wander off and, you know, go and be hunter-gatherers or live elsewhere? That population question was absolutely acute. So what you see over time, and when I say over time, I mean over a very long period of time, over thousands of years, is that those in charge at the top of these states start to put pressure on the family, because the family is the unit of population. That's how you get more people. So pressure falls over time on young women to have as many children as possible, and pressure falls on young men, because they're not able to have those children, to fight and defend the state, to kind of create a system of loyalty within the state so that people don't leave. And you can see then, in that twin preoccupation with birth rates and defense, the roots of some of our gendered stereotypes now, this idea that women should be mothers and men should be fighters, or, you know, brave and stoic. And that's still a preoccupation for modern day patriarchal states. You only have to look at, for example, Russia. Right now, they're facing a huge crisis in terms of recruiting people into the military, and they're losing people because of the war in Ukraine. Just recently, the government launched an advertising campaign to young men who are leaving, who are trying to leave the country, that they should be a man and stay and fight, you know, calling on that kind of masculine stereotype. And last year, the Russian state also introduced the Mother Heroine Medal for women who have more than 10 kids. So again, calling on that idea of your role, your duty as a citizen, as a woman, is to have as many children as possible.
Oh my gosh, that exhausts me even just thinking about it. So you've said that patriarchy disadvantages both men and women. Is this how these roles that people are almost kind of forced into?
Well, absolutely. I mean, how limiting is it to be told that your entire existence is reliant on you fulfilling the role of only a mother? And the same for men, that your entire existence is predicated on you defending the state, being available to fight and die if necessary. That is what the patriarchal state demands of people, these very narrow, rigid roles, which, as we know from our own experience, is not something we all feel comfortable with. You know, not every woman wants to be a mother or is a good mother, and not every man, certainly not every man, wants to fight. So it's limiting for all of us. And really, this system, this patriarchal system, only really serves those at the top.
How do you view the relationship between the patriarchy and capitalism?
I do. I mean, I get asked this question quite often these days, I think because we're going through a moment in time in which there is this disillusionment with capitalism and the inequality it's bred in societies. And I think it's the inequality really that hits hardest when it comes to women's rights. Because if you already have a society, a patriarchal society that's been set up on the principle that a woman will stay at home and give her labor for free, then how much worse of a situation does that put her in if she is ever to try to work in an economy in which winner takes all, or in which there is such a huge gulf between those at the top and those at the bottom? It's still the case that women disproportionately work in jobs in which they are paid less. You know, so many women work in, you know, caring professions or cleaning, jobs that do not give them economic freedom. And because they don't give them economic freedom, also keep them trapped in relationships in which they don't have as much agency or authority as they might otherwise. So I think these are definitely interconnected things. This idea of property and capital, I think, is intrinsically part of how we should understand patriarchy today.
You've talked about the impact that dismantling the patriarchy would have on religion, marriage. You know, we've talked about the state. Talk a little bit more about what some of those impacts would be.
Well, you know, it was very difficult for me coming to the end of this book. You know, I'm a journalist, I'm not an academic, so I was learning alongside writing this book. It was radically changing the way I thought about the world and the way I thought about power. And at the end, I didn't know what my conclusion would be. You know, would it be optimistic or would it be pessimistic, given how difficult things are at the moment for many women in the world? You know, you only have to look in Afghanistan at how the Taliban is so grossly clamping down on women's freedoms, girls' freedoms, not even the freedom to be educated. In Iran, these protests happening, trying to claw back the freedom to wear what they want, to be educated, to navigate the world without a male guardian. All these terrible changes that are happening in the world that are making things worse for women. And there was a big part of me that thought at the end of writing this book, how can I be hopeful at the end of this? But then right at the end, those protests began in Iran. And the final chapter of the book is about the 1979 revolution in Iran and how after that things really deteriorated in terms of women's rights. And I just thought, well, people are always pushing back. We're always fighting back. Even young children do not handle unfairness well. Nobody wants to live in an unequal society. And as long as that's the case, as long as we're always pushing, then I think we have to be optimistic.
So the conclusion is the patriarchy is not inevitable, right? Do you think our societies can change?
It's absolutely not inevitable. We can live any way we want. What holds us back is the bravery to push back and reimagine new ways of living. And sometimes part of the reason that's difficult is because we're so embedded in the cultures that we're in. We're so invested in the societies we've already created, even if they don't serve us very well. But I would love for us to just be able to step outside that and imagine something different. Because if we can imagine it, we can build it.
You wrote that if we really want to smash the patriarchy, quote, what we really need to do is to rediscover our ability to love and care for each other. What lessons do you think we can learn from the past about how to get there?
You know, the damage that the patriarchal state has done to families and to relationships is to sow distrust and animosity where there doesn't need to be distrust and animosity. You know, it creates rifts between parents and their children because parents are then imposing these very narrow gendered rules on their kids. They're not allowing them to just live the way they might otherwise live. It creates rifts between husbands and wives or between partners because, again, they're being forced to follow these very rigid gender rules that may not suit them and may not be comfortable for them. So really the way we push back is to live our own way, to say that we don't care about the rules that society sets. We are going to do what makes us and our families happy, to learn to love each other again, to learn to trust each other again, to not put the needs of patriarchy, you know, these very narrow ideas, this ideology, this damaging ideology above everything else, and just nurture each other. Because that basic unit of the family, I think, is where that nurturing should be able to happen within our communities. It's love that will draw us out of this problem. It is not hatred or division.
I've been talking with journalist and author Angela Saini. She'll deliver the Mercantile Library's Science and Nature lecture on September 19th, based on her most recent book, The Patriarchs, The Origins of Inequality. You can find more information on our website, wvxu.org. Angela, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Stephen Baum. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.